You are my whiskey love fire. I am your Tennessee cowboy. I went through Texas for you. I chased the Dragon King. I hunted Rabbit Squirrel. Whiskey love fire. You are my whiskey love fire. Yeah, it is Friday, July the 8th, 2022, Bo Blimp Doc. I'll tell you how optimistic I am. I am, as of right now, 90 days optimistic, which means if you ask me, how do you feel about the world about 3 months out? And right now it's like, it ain't so bad. I might have some money in my pocket because I might not screw up this job might be real, and you know, the company might not go out of business for 3 months, and I'll get paid the money, and I'll do the work, and I'll get paid the money, and I'll buy cocaine and hookers. Because it is July the 8th, 2022, almost 9 a.m. Bo Blimp Doc. Mountain Standard Time, thank God it's Friday. All of us stare into our own hole of regret each morning as we awake. It's a vomit hole. It's a place where we bury our dreams. It's a place where we strangle our hopes. And so but it's Friday. And the vomit hole is gone. You woke up to a sunshiny day. A little kitty cat said hello, motherfucker. That was beautiful. It was so fucking beautiful, that little kitty cat saying hello. Yeah, I don't know what to tell you people. I am 90 days optimistic. And if you think that that's not enough, I can see your point. I mean, you have an argument to make. I am 90 days believing that, you know, for the next 90 days, I can think about going on camping trips and going fishing and definitely affording a moderate amount of actual beer versus Mormon Utah beer. Yeah, because I think I'm done with it. I'm done with the 5% sugar beer. I don't know what they do with the beer when they deliver here to Utah, but you might as well just be drinking corn syrup with a little hint of alcohol. And the problem with that strategy is that if you're a little bit diabetic, that motherfucking Mormon beer will make you full on. Yeah. But I am going to drink less beer, right? Because it's Bo Blimp Doc. I want to get into shape. I want to start working out. I'm going to get my abs going. Abmaster 6000. Abmaster 45. Abmaster Gamma, shove a firecracker, you know, up your butt. Yeah, Abmaster. So the first topic relates to an essay that was published in the year 1850 by a man, but it doesn't matter, it could have been a woman, okay? Didn't have to be a guy, but the man's name was Frederick Bastiat. A French dude, right? He published this as a pamphlet. And back in the day, they didn't have blogs. So if you want to know what you did, if you wanted to blog, you basically wrote up about, you know, maybe 500, 600, 1,000 words, maybe more. You put it into a pamphlet, or sometimes it was short enough, terse enough, you could put it on a little piece of paper and paste it to the wall. But the point is, you handed out these pamphlets because you didn't have blogs, and it worked. I mean, they were relatively cheap to print, probably, for someone like him. And you could hand them out to 100 people who actually know how to read. And frankly, the written word was held more precious back then by people who could read. I mean, it's probably, yeah, because they didn't have as much to choose from. But brothers and sisters, if you analyze the data mass of the World Wide Web, what you'll find is not very surprising. It's a lot of porn, a lot of online gaming, and a lot of bullshit. And it's true, some of it is used to exchange great ideas, but it turns out you don't need the whole thing for that. Most of it's working on gambling and gaming, prostitution and pornography, and all types of other stuff that people don't want to talk about politely over coffee. You know, like the coffee I'm drinking right now, as I bash you out. The title of the pamphlet by Frederick Bastiat, who is a famous economist, or I'd say economic thinker. I would call him a famous economic philosopher who lived in the 19th century, and he is, you know, prized and loved amongst those of us who believe in freedom. So I wanted to say that before we continue. The title of the pamphlet, and again, this is originally was written in French, I presume, so I'm reading it in English, but the title of the pamphlet, What is Seen and What is Not Seen? In the economic sphere, an act, a habit, an institution, a law produces not only one effect, but a series of effects. Of these effects, the first alone is immediate. It appears simultaneously with its cause. It is seen. The other effects emerge only subsequently. They are not seen. We are fortunate if we foresee them. There is only one difference between a bad economist and a good one. The bad economist confines himself to the visible effect. The good economist takes into account both the effect that can be seen and those effects that must be foreseen. Yet this difference is tremendous, for it almost always happens that when the immediate consequence is favorable, the latter consequences are disastrous, and vice versa. Whence it follows that the bad economist pursues a small present good that will be followed by a great evil to come, while the good economist pursues a great good to come at the risk of a small present evil. The same thing, of course, is true of health and morals. Often, the sweeter the first fruit of a habit, the more bitter are its later fruits. For example, debauchery, sloth, prodigality. When a man is impressed by the first effect that is seen and has not yet learned to discern the effects that are not seen, he indulges in deplorable habits not only through natural inclination, but deliberately. This explains man's necessarily painful evolution. Ignorance surrounds him at his cradle, therefore he regulates his acts according to their first consequences, the only ones that in his infancy he can see. It is only after a long time that he learns to take account of the others. Two very different masters teach him this lesson, experience and foresight. Experience teaches efficaciously, but brutally. It instructs us in all the effects of an act by making us feel them, and we cannot fail to learn eventually from having been burned ourselves that fire burns. I should prefer, in so far as possible, to replace this rude teacher with one more gentle, foresight. For that reason, I shall investigate the consequences of several economic phenomena, contrasting those that are seen with those that are not seen. The broken window. Have you ever been a witness to the fury of that solid citizen, James Goodfellow? When his incorrigible son has happened to break a pane of glass? If you have been present at this spectacle, certainly you must have also have observed that the onlookers, even there are as many as 30 of them, seem with one accord to offer the unfortunate owner the self-same consolation. It's an ill wind that blows nobody some good. Such accidents keep industry going. Everybody has to make a living. What would become of the glaziers if no one ever broke a window? Now, this formula of condolence contains a whole theory that it is a good idea for us to expose flagrante delicto in this very simple case, since it is exactly the same as that which unfortunately underlies most of our economic institutions. Suppose that it will cost 6 francs to repair the damage. If you mean that the accident gives 6 francs worth of encouragement to the aforesaid industry, I agree. I do not contest it in any way. Your reasoning is correct. The glazier will come, do his job, receive 6 francs, congratulate himself, and bless in his heart the careless child. That is what is seen. But if, by way of deduction, you conclude, as happens only too often, that it is good to break windows, that it helps to circulate money, that it results in encouraging industry in general, I am obliged to cry out, that will never do. Your theory stops at what is seen. It does not take account of what is not seen. It is not seen that, since our citizen has spent 6 francs for one thing, he will not be able to spend them for another. It is not seen that if he had not had a window pane to replace, he would have replaced, for example, his worn-out shoes, or added another book to his library. In brief, he would have put his 6 francs to some use or other, for which he will have not now have them. Let us next consider industry in general. The window having been broken, the glass industry gets 6 francs worth of encouragement. That is what is seen. If the window had not been broken, the shoe industry, or some other, would have received 6 francs worth of encouragement. That is what is not seen. And if we were to take into consideration what is not seen, because it is a negative factor as well as what is seen, because it is a positive factor, we should understand that there is no benefit to industry in general or to national employment as a whole, whether windows are broken or not broken. Now let us consider James Goodfellow. On the first hypothesis, that of the broken window, he spends 6 francs and has neither more nor less than before the enjoyment of one window. On the second, that in which the accident did not happen, he would have spent 6 francs for new shoes and would have had the enjoyment of a pair of shoes as well as of a window. Now, if James Goodfellow is part of a society, we must conclude that society, considering its labors and enjoyments, has lost the value of the broken window, from which, by generalizing, we arrive at this unexpected conclusion. Society loses the value of objects unnecessarily destroyed. And at this aphorism, which will make the hair of the protectionist stand on end, to break, to destroy, to dissipate is not to encourage national employment, or more briefly, destruction is not profitable. What will the monitor of industry say to this, or the disciples of the estimable, Saint Chamans, who has calculated with such precision what industry would gain from the burning of Paris because of the houses that would have to be rebuilt? I am sorry to upset his ingenious calculations, especially since their spirit has passed into our legislation. But I beg him to begin them again, entering what is not seen in the ledger beside what is seen. The reader must apply himself to observe that there are not only 2 people but 3 in the little drama that I have presented. James Goodfellow represents the consumer, reduced by destruction to 1 enjoyment instead of 2. The other, under the figure of the glazier, shows us the producer whose industry the accident encourages. The third is the shoemaker, or any other manufacturer whose industry is correspondingly discouraged by the same cause. It is this third person who is always in the shadow, and who personifying what is not seen, is an essential element of the problem. It is he who makes us understand how absurd it is to see a profit in destruction. It is he who will soon teach us that it is equally absurd to see a profit in trade restriction, which is, after all, nothing more or nor less than partial destruction. So if you get to the bottom of all these arguments advanced in the favor of restrictionist measures, you will find only a phrase that of that common cliché. What would become of the glaziers if no one ever broke any windows? This was a pamphlet written by Frederick Bastiat in the year 1850. And I have a link to one of the podcasts. I did two podcasts on this in early 2020. One of them was titled Destructo Force. And the key thing about Destructo Force is that it existed in a universe that was the opposite of ours. You know, the Spock universe that he goes to, or rather he's already there. You know, Kirk gets transported to this other universe and there's evil Spock. That's what it is. Goatee Spock, Dark Spock, Tantalus Device Spock, hard and sexy and ready to go Spock in the dark evil universe. Well, imagine a dark evil, you know, Spock wears a fucking goatee universe. And there's an opposite version of Frederick Bastiat. And he convinces Napoleon III to take the army, the navy, you know, all the armed forces of France and turn them into Destructo Force. Because Bastiat convinces him, listen, buddy, what if I took this grenade and lit the wick and tossed it at that bakery, pal, the one you just gave me because you're crazy, Napoleon III. That's right. What if I took this grenade and blew up that bakery, Emperor Napoleon III? Wouldn't that create a whole bunch of fucking jobs? There's the job for the guy that has to pick up the bodies. He gets to sell the bodies to the medical school. Okay? They're the witches and the harlot clans and the Grumbic folk who will eat all the other parts if you give them to them. There's all that work to rebuild whatever somebody builds there. And I'm sure there's going to be a bunch of people who get real sad and donate to the church. So doesn't that actually create a bunch of money and jobs, all the jobs to fix all that broken, busted up shit? Because that is the logic, brothers and sisters, of the United States government my whole lifetime. It really is. They'll talk about the economy growing, but for the most, in really good times, and people say, what about the 1980s? And whatever, you want to call those good times, fine. But in those good times of the 80s and the 90s, it was parasitic, but it was really malignant. It was still malignant. It still kind of destroyed the body. It's just that it didn't destroy it as fast. So when it comes to voting for Republicans versus Democrats, I think the simple message is, do you want a dude tossing like six sticks of dynamite at you every day, or do you want a dude just tossing one stick of dynamite? I mean, one stick could still probably kill you, but you might be able to dodge it and only get burnt up and maybe just break a fucking leg or get a bad concussion, a shock concussion. But, you know, if someone's tossing six sticks of dynamite at you, I don't know how to put it, you probably aren't going to live. So that's the choice between the parties who offer you up economic solutions. They make the argument of that character in the story. They make the argument that good for the glaziers, they have jaws making glass, right? You know? You remember all those stories from 2020 about BLM and Antifa and BRICS being let, you know, there are BRICS there waiting for them to pick up and use. Listen, folks, I took a lot of videotape of BLM Antifa nonsense. And I say videotape, I recorded a lot of digital video in the summer of 2020. And all I can tell you is I saw a lot of undercover cops pretending to be BLM. I saw a lot of orchestrated bullshit, a lot of rubber cones. And folks, if you're in a situation like the one they claimed, you're not using rubber cones. You're using concertina wire. Sorry. You know, this is what people don't understand. The difference between fake and reality is a rubber cone and concertina wire. When you see concertina wire, then you will start knowing it's real. Okay? Imagine being in the front of a crowd and being pushed into triple strand concertina. You might as well go through a cheese grater. So yeah, if this thing were real, you wouldn't have seen the hokey pokey dancy schmancy, we're here to help out the Chapchosians with all kinds of shit to write on bullshit. It was crap. And it was crap that people's taxpayer dollars paid for. There were people with $500,000 condos in that neighborhood, you know, and I see them walk out their door and shake their head. And keep in mind, Ferrari of Seattle, that yeah, had a couple windows broken. Ferrari of Seattle, which was not burnt down. Ferrari of Seattle was about, you know, a stone's throw away from Chapchosia. And explain the fuck why that place wasn't burnt the fuck out. Explain why they marched down to the King County whatever and set a dumpster on fire, which was reported as a prison burning down, instead of just tossing those little fire grenades at the Jesuits, which was closer. Like, they could have just, you know, stopped at Seattle U. The reality is this was orchestrated 100% bullshit. 100%. And all of it destructive. There were restaurants in my neighborhood gone. 100% gone. They will never come back, probably. I don't know. Maybe they will. Like I said, I'm 90 days optimistic. So who knows? Maybe for 90 days, right? I have a lot of people in my family who focus on what they can see. They see, you know, and it's not just my family. It's the whole Seattle world. The people think Seattle's this liberal place, but it's really kind of a really crude mixture of communism and a really skeezy type of fraudulent activity involving house flipping. But it's weird. And, you know, they'll talk to me about things like, well, for example, a friend of a friend I had dinner with, in 2013, which I guess about 9 years ago. And I'm sitting there and explaining to them that the UN had just published a report, the UN food program had just published a report linking Bernanke's printing of money to, you know, to the Arab Spring and to massive starvation. And I pointed out that without that printing of money, her industry, because she was a real estate person, her industry would have pancaked. And it was like, well, I don't care. I don't know those people. But what she should have said is, I don't see those people. I don't see those people at all. That is the thing that is not seen. That is what Bastiat's talking about. Another unseen thing, which really can be seen, but ironically is not looked at, is homelessness in this country. I'll have a lot of house flipper types who say, oh yeah, thank God for Fannie Freddie, thank God for all that liquidity, I can flip homes and make up $1 billion. But then in the very next voice, in the very next sentence, really, they'll complain about the homeless people in the neighborhood, in the alley. In the very next sentence, they'll say, all these scummy homeless people, why can't we ship them to McNeil Island and they can try to fish out of that poison Puget Sound that the orcas can't even find food in. Maybe they'll fish up a meal and they'll eat their mercury and they'll die there. You see, that's actually darker than what is not seen. At least in the what is not seen case, you can pretend ignorance. But you see this everywhere. In Seattle, every major city. And the excuse is, well, they're all addicts and they're all crazy. You know, folks, if I translated to you to German in the early 1930s, your shit would sound a lot alike. It really would. It's true. There are criminals who are homeless. There are drug addicts who are homeless. There are drunk, crazy old bastards like me that are homeless. There are people in the homeless groups that probably deserve their world. But my guess is it isn't as big a percentage as you might think. But there are hundreds of thousands of people who simply dropped off the economic radar. They are the not seen. They are the unpeople. They are not counted in the labor force. Literally the unseen. When they give you that unemployment number, these people are never counted. Ever. And so who knows how many there are? They are the unseen. In the very least, they are the ignored. And when you can see them, when they become obnoxious because they're living in the streets and they can't survive, they're pooping everywhere, they're causing problems, when you can see them, your solution is, well, maybe we can just turn them into dog food. Brothers and sisters, if you don't believe in God, you are simply facing the consequences of reality. If you do believe in God, you should meditate on Bastiat's little pamphlet, because it's not just about economics, it's about right and wrong. In many ways, it is the logical connection between the physical world and God. Okay, this is not Eden. I'm not sure the Lord would have loved Adam and Eve going around setting trees on fire, but this is not Eden. So if they did do that, the trees probably just magically grew back. But this isn't Eden. If you bust up somebody's home, you've destroyed it, somebody's got to fix it. If you shut down the civilized world over best case scenario, a mistake, and in reality a giant psyop, and you do that for more than a year and you keep threatening to go back to that, yeah, that's not Eden. That's a dark place and that has consequences. Not Eden. I have a link to a Zero Hedge article. I'm not going to read it. It deals with some study, some analysis, basically showing that the stimulus checks had no effect on the poor. And, you know, I made a comment on Zero Hedge the other day that if you had a $300,000 home and I burnt it down and then I handed you $50, you were still out, you know, a negative $299,950. That's not a good economic transaction. That's not a good outcome. And I don't know how anybody could feel restored. The reality is, it's far worse than the analysis of Bastiat at this point. I mean, I think Bastiat still kind of assumed a basic morality with people. The reality is, if someone broke a window, a cop shows up, takes some money, probably someone who wants to put the kid in juvenile detention gets some money, a psychologist gets some money, and the truth is, you add up all that money, there's not enough money. So not only does that broken window steal a little money in that effect, but there's a whole bunch of shit that gets stolen as a result. And the reality is, it isn't just 6 francs, you know, net zero. It's 6 francs, and now we're minus a bublillion. That's the current situation. The broken windows phenomena is inherent to the United States government. Everything about it, whether it's agricultural policy, whether it's policy concerning oil, you pick the topic. And what they do every day is bust up windows. And then they try to convince you that the unseen effect, it's always going to happen. It was inevitable. Nothing you could do about it. That's what they'll tell you. You'll mention some effect of globalism as defined by globalism, the mercantilist high-level negotiated, you know, trade deals globalism. If you try to explain to them that this would have bad outcomes, it's like, oh, no, it won't. And when they show up, oh, but those were always going to happen. It was inevitable. It is inevitable. If you dose me with radiation, enough radiation, it's inevitable that I will die. If you come back later and say my death was incidental, I'll want to punch you in the fucking face. I don't know what else to say about this. Destructo force is a joke. We don't want to have people going around busting up places. But if you think about United States policy and the United States government vis-a-vis the American people, but also people around the world, what I see are a lot of fucking broken windows. When we're talking Himalayas-sized mountains of broken windows. A lot of stuff, and you want to talk the unseen. I've mentioned this before. During the Cold War, the U.S. government used tactical nukes to frack for natural gas a couple times. But those are the couple times we know about. Okay? They experimented on Americans and got caught a few times, but those are the times we know about. There's the Marshall Islanders that were literally left with a giant pile of nuclear waste, and now it's, you know, near ocean level, but we don't talk about it. But think about the other stuff. You see, you want to talk about the unseen of the United States government? It's like asking the question, okay, we know about Wounded Knee. We know about some major massacres of Native Americans during the 19th century. But here's the question. Do we know about all of them? Like, isn't it just as likely or more likely that for every one massacre that they couldn't keep a secret, there's probably 10 that people did? And maybe it wasn't always hundreds of Native Americans. Maybe sometimes it was just a single family. But it probably happened all across this country during the 19th century. Okay? That is definitely the unseen, right? The thing we don't have to see, the effect that is almost buried in a mass grave. So when you think about the unseen with the United States government, I think it's horribly, almost love in a Lovecraftian way, darker than Bastiat could ever imagine, that there are these time bombs of stupidity that are still out there someplace that we might not find out about for 1,000 years. Like Project Skyball. Project Skyball. It's the ultimate, the super revenge weapon. They launched it in 1964, Bo Blimpdoc. And again, there is no Project Skyball. This is notional. Yes, in 1964, Bo Blimpdoc, they launched Project Skyball. It was a nuclear weapon of 100,000 megatons. Maybe it was just like a cluster. Yeah. It had 100 megaton bombs. That's not so bad, right? Project Skyball was sent on an elliptical orbit to come back to return to Earth orbit in the year 2023, Bo Blimpdoc. And if the computer on board, if the computer figured out none of its base stations were operating, then it would have to launch. Imagine that. Imagine a death weapon that the United States government launched in the 60s on a big elliptical orbit, and then it comes back in 2023, loaded with, let's say, several gigatons of nuclear weapons, all kinds of MIRVs to launch in all kinds of cities and directions. But it was expected to contact its, you know, home base saying, Skyball, okay, stand down, Skyball. It's okay, Skyball. There's nothing to kill here. You can go home. Go back on another elliptical orbit, Skyball, and come back later and check in. And so Skyball checks in 2023, and there's no base station because, well, it was turned into a kind of like drag queen reading room in the White House. It's gone. All that equipment. They didn't know what it was. They didn't care. It's like, what's this? This is something electronical. It doesn't connect to my iPhones. I don't care. And so they tore it all out to put in the reading room for the drag queens. And Skyball launches. Now, given that Skyball is a government program, let's say at least 50% of the missiles fail. The other 50% hit their targets, maybe. Who knows? I mean, this is a notional joke. There is no Skyball, we hope. But if you're asking me, could there be little Bastiat unseen time bombs that this government leaves behind long after it's gone, long after it's collapsed, which I think is happening right now? It's collapsing, if you have eyes to see. Long after it's gone, could there be little fucking time bombs left in the ground for somebody just to accident upon? Some mine, in a figurative sense, some landmine that some kid steps on. Could there be bioweapons labs, you know, that are left running to find some killer virus to kill everybody? Who knows? At this point, the way I envision the U.S. government, it's like a giant crocodile, but it's been eaten out by parasites. And so all of its locomotion, all of it is due to the parasites wriggling inside. And the skin sac that is the crocodile is about to crack open. And some of those little, you know, parasites are just going to take their money and go to Cabo. I mean, I'd rather see them, you know, be destroyed, but fine, go to Cabo, get drunk, die of herpes, I don't care. But some of these parasites might be biolabs, they could be. Some of these parasites might get a hold of nuclear weapons, that could happen. So it's not safer necessarily once it collapses. You're going to have a lot of parasites that have a lot of that unseen power, that unseen power to do harm. So that's a long-winded way of saying that when we ask questions about the subject, you know, when we say to ourselves, is it good to say what Nancy Pelosi said in 2010, that the earthquake in Haiti was a good thing for them? Was that smart? It's the dumbest thing you can fucking imagine. it'll be good for their economy that they had an earthquake. It's people who talk about the pandemic that way. Oh, there's all these new jobs you're going to have. You know, we're going to have some of these jobs for a while. This is a Potemkin economy, and nobody tells me anything about the truth, or you. We get information that is, you know, ironically meant to be information. But at some point, it's going to fail. And there are the indications that we're heading that way. So all the things people say about all the benefits of destruction will reveal themselves as false pretty soon. That's where I'm standing on that. But Dan, we're in post-scarcity, so we can just blow shit up, Oblimta. Yeah. If you believe in post-scarcity in the year 2022, 2023 is going to be a real problem for you. Because right now, we have a bounty at cheap prices. You need to understand what I just said. All the diesel, all the gasoline, all the food is still way too cheap. It's not because I want it more expensive. That's not the fucking point. I'm talking about foresight, the way that Bastiat talked about foresight. Right now, whatever you can buy at the grocery store, whatever you can buy at Home Depot that you actually need is still on sale because your money still works. We're not heading towards hyperinflation or stagflation or a recession. What is going to happen here pretty soon is your money simply won't work. It'll do nothing. There won't be some massive spike in prices because here's the punchline. There won't be anything to buy. You could have $1 million and walk into the Home Depot and it will simply be empty. The grocery store will be empty. That is going to happen. It didn't have to be that way. It could have been different. But all you all wanted to have your, I want to be seen, destructo force economy. You wanted to have your doomsday economics. You wanted to believe that it was okay that somebody's house burnt down. You wanted to believe it was okay that you took free money, a lot of it even taxpayer money, to participate in a real estate pyramid scheme that led to a lot of people getting homeless. Maybe even a few people that might have changed the world, motherfucker. All you all who wear your coffee filters today, who wore them in 2020, yeah, you shut the fuck up, Mr. Unseen, Mr. Consequence. You're the dude that left a lot of fucking debris behind. Even if all you did, well, all I did was obey, you fucked up. All I did was obey. All I did was obey. Yeah, if you thought that it was good to have an economy based upon inherent material destruction, then what's going about to happen is really going to be shocking and painful for you. It's going to hurt everybody, but it's going to be worse for you because your paradigm is so broken. And then you'll think back to opportunities where you could have said no. Someone offered you the visible consequence of free money, and you could have said no. You could have said no to the whole fucking thing. But you didn't. So welcome to the world of the unseen. Next topic. Here's a quote from Dr. Freckles. People think it's a choice between being a chief or a shaman. I say be both in proper measure. Now, this is kind of related to a subject I've talked about vis-a-vis Christianity in recent weeks, and that the idea of a specialized caste or job vocation role of someone to be priest or minister, in my opinion, is not inherent to Christianity. What is inherent to Christianity is literally the opposite, or at least something that is very different, and that is that we are all supposed to minister to each other. You know, Christ shows he is willing to wash your feet, but in doing so, he's trying to teach you. And he's trying to teach you that it's your job to wash other people's feet. And on a deeper level, he's trying to teach you that it's your job to teach. And I know, you say, well, it's scary, Dan. I didn't go to divinity school. I didn't go to the monastery. I haven't read every version of the King James or other versions of the Bible. I haven't done all these things. Therefore, I cannot have an opinion. And here's the only answer I can give you. We should all read the Bible and we should all pray. And as far as the best Bible goes, I don't really know yet. And that's the truth. I've read several versions of different Bibles. You know, some Bibles have the Book of Maccabees in it, and some don't. And I've had explained to me, well, you know, some Protestants don't believe in Maccabees, or they're anti-Semitic or something. Here's the deal. Some Bibles include Maccabees, some do not. Okay? There's a lot of Apocrypha that has been rejected, even though it's referenced in the Bible. You know, the stories of Enoch are referenced in the Bible, and yet the Book of Enoch is nowhere to be found in the Bible. So when it comes to the question, well, Dan, I don't know if I know enough about the Bible. Well, in my view, when it comes to the Word, and that's from, I believe, John, I think it's 1 John, but when it comes to the first, there was the Word. When it comes to the Word, the only one that knows the Word is God. The rest of us try to understand it a little. But the truth of it all is not something we completely understand. So before you say, well, I cannot be a minister because I don't know the Bible, well, get a Bible, you know, consult some friends. I think the NIV is okay, but there are other versions of the Bible to look at. But get a version of the Bible and then read it. And you can start at the beginning, which is a great idea, but you could also start at the end, which might not be the best idea, or just open it up. And then when you're done, just pray. You don't have to do any other prayer than ask the Lord for something related to your faith, or maybe even to guide you to your faith. That's the first step. But the answer that I don't know the Bible, therefore I cannot minister to my brothers and sisters in Christ, that's the wrong answer. You know, the other thing I'll hear about it is, well, I can't really do public speaking, or I can't, you know, I don't have the resources for a YouTube channel. Folks, you know what you need to have a church? One other person than yourself and Christ. That's it. Three agencies or spirits or pieces fit into that. There is Christ there, and obviously the Holy Spirit, so I guess you can make that too. There's you and the other person, so that's four. But the point is, in terms of people, all you need is you and somebody else, okay? Some other person who's willing to do a reading, talk about it, and then you pray. And guess what? You just had church, and you can do that every day. You don't have to just do it on Sunday. You could do it every morning. You could have your friend meet you for coffee. You could read the Bible together. You could talk about the reading, and then you could pray. And I'll let you on a secret. You just had church. The rest of it is a lot of ritual that might not be related to anything Christian at all. That's the truth. When it comes to all the rituals, including the ones that the Protestants took with them, when it comes to every ritual that is practiced in a standard Catholic ceremony, for example, much of that might just be ritual. I'm not saying it's evil or bad. I'm just saying you don't need it to have a church. You don't need a priest or a minister. It doesn't mean that at all. We're not supposed to go there. We're supposed to be disciples of Christ, which means we're supposed to minister to each other. People do think it's a choice between it being a chief or a shaman. You know, amongst Christians, they think it's a choice between simply going to church on Sunday or, you know, trying to lead a congregation. And that's not the choice. The choice is, do you want to be a Christian? And with respect to this quote of Dr. Freckles and how it applies to the world around us, this is what I mean. In a lot of cases, when it comes to the business world, people will think, well, If you're not on a management track by a certain age, there's something wrong with you. And here's what I would say. A lot of the management stuff is very Prussian, very authoritarian, and probably not productive. It should be more like people should share roles over time. And maybe they spend most of their time in a role they're competent at, but periodically people should learn to be chiefs and not just shamans. You know, the shamans can do certain kinds of things, the chiefs can do other kinds of things. We should be open to both possibilities, that sometimes it's our job to lead, and sometimes it's our job to teach, and sometimes it's our job to do both. And sometimes it's our job to simply follow, and that's okay too, to listen, to be a good listener, to learn. Anyways, next topic. So there was this pope a long time ago in the time of Galileo. And Galileo had this, you know, astronomical device, this telescope set up. And he said, listen, Mr. Pope, why don't you look into this telescope and I'll show you the moons of Jupiter. I think it was that. And the Pope said, buddy, I'm not going to look into that contraption because probably the devil made it. And the devil will show me whatever the devil wants me to see. If the devil wants me to see those moons, I'll see those fucking moons. See those motherfucking moons, Mr. Galileo. Now, of course, the real story isn't like that. And I don't think the Pope swears or uses the F-bomb at all. I don't know. We weren't there. You know, it's Italian. I'm sure they had a version of the F-bomb even for the Pope. But something like that maybe happened. You know, it's one of those stories. You can look back at the Pope and you can make fun of the Pope. And I like making fun of the Pope, I mean, in general, because, you know, I'm one of those ex-Catholics who just can't get enough of it, beating up on the Pope. I'm a bad guy. No, I just don't know that the Pope is what we think he is either. That being said, this particular Pope in the time of Galileo gets beat up on, but when I look at the monkey herpes, the 2020 COVID pandemic psyop that is still not over. When I look at all of the language around the Ukraine, what's going on there, which continues as a painful wound. When I look at all of the trust the science crap, especially the shit coming out of NASA, I am left with the possibility that this Pope was onto something. I'm not arguing that you should be a Luddite or you should say, oh my God, that's technology. You're going to lie to me with it. No, don't be a Luddite. Don't be afraid of technology. But also, don't be fucking stupid. Especially when it comes to information technology. Because there's a key word there. Information. Which also implies that it's a technology for working with information. Which also implies that you can manipulate, control, or even delete the information. That's also built into that information technology. So when people say, you know, that Pope was crazy, why was he afraid that Mr. Galileo had some deal with the devil or something? Listen, I'm not defending the Pope, but I am kind of understanding the perspective. I have the same perspective at this point. I've seen with my eyes the consequences of the shenanigans of 2020 and trusting the science without asking any questions. That sounds a lot like what the Catholic Church was asking Mr. Galileo to do, to just trust the church. The church knows everything, and throw that devil telescope away. Yeah, the shoe's on the other foot now. And maybe that's the way it was always supposed to be. I'm not really what you would call a long-term conspiracy theorist. I simply think that, you know, unearned wealth attracts a lot of really sketchy people. And if you pile a lot of stolen wealth someplace like Washington, D.C., you're going to attract a lot of fucking sketchy people. It might not be more fucking complicated than that, by the way. Mr. Hanlon. You put a giant pile of loot in a swamp, and you'll have people out there digging after that until the end of time. Next topic. It's kind of on a theme, isn't it? Here's a quote from Dr. Freckles. Transform your small business. Transform your small business. Transform your small business with dynamite. With dynamite. Transform your small business with dynamite. That's a joke, right? Listen. If you believe that what Nancy Pelosi said in 2010 made sense, if you believe, you know, the thing about the earthquake in Haiti being good for them, if you think the COVID created jobs, then why don't you like transform your fucking small business with a box of fucking dynamite. Because that's the logic. I mean, you're really doing it wrong. You're doing it slow. You're voting, I'm going to vote next year, and then they'll fuck my neighbor in 24 to 36 months. No, shut the fuck up. You're doing it wrong, okay? Why don't you just take a fucking box of dynamite and walk down your neighborhood at night and toss dynamite at the cars and the cats and the dogs? Why don't you go to your neighbor's home and blow it up? I mean, think of all the fucking jobs that would create. Why not? If you think your business is a success because of the COVID, because of what you've seen, the consequences for your pocketbook, if you think the COVID was a real boon for your business, why don't you get a box of fucking dynamite and just start tossing it at your business, at your property, at the things you own? Why don't you do that? Transform your small business with dynamite, motherfucker. Yeah. We learn a great deal more when the path is unclear or when it's wrong altogether, Dr. Freckles. And what does that mean? Well, I think that one of the ways we fail to learn, and that includes your good friend Dan, is by walking the easy path and not, you know, straying too far off of it. Because the easy path has all the monkey meat, the easy path has all the grungo cubes, the easy path has the beer and the hookers and the cocaine. The easy path contains everything that you want and everything you need. The easy path. You know, some people get kicked off of it and they end up homeless, but for those of us who stay on the easy street, it's pretty fucking nice. So why go down the alley? Why check out what's happening, you know, beyond the veneer? Just stay in your fucking lane, right? But in reality, if you take a walk down those side streets, you might actually see things, kind of like what Bastiat was talking about. You might actually see things not only you're not supposed to see, but more importantly, you probably should. Okay? Things that are off limits, things that are forbidden, things that are taboo according to the organization of your society. Yeah, you can find them, but you have to get off the easy street. You have to get off the path that everybody says is the right one. Because, and I don't know how to put it, truth is not democratic. And if most people believe something stupid, it doesn't stop being stupid. It, in some ways, it actually becomes more stupid. We learn a great deal more when the path is unclear, or when it's wrong altogether. Dr. Freckles. Next topic. So I saw this thing pop up on, you know, Zero Hedge. What happened to Opie's mom? Like, Opie had a mom. Mayberry was a thing, you know, back in the day. Opie's mom. Whatever happened to Opie's mom? Opie's mom, after she couldn't take it any longer, she hated those ginger freaks. She needed to get into that 57 Chevy and step on the gas and head to New York, Opie's mom. Opie's mom got strung out on heroin, you know, and went down to Soho. She met up with a couple of Goombas. They turned her into the street, and she started hooking. That's what happened to Opie's mom. Opie's mom ran off with the circus. She lives with Yerkes, who runs the rackety rickety roller coaster, motherfucker. Opie's mom. That's enough of that. Ranch water. What am I going to say about ranch water? If you drink something called ranch water, you deserve the poisoning you're going to get. So the other day, I was walking down the street. I was on my way to Stringo's off of Grinken Avenue. I was going to get several gallons of Brinktus juice or polonium, and a mixture of Drinktus and, you know, probably barium, and crush it into a fine salt, and, you know, next thing's next. But I run into this dude, and he takes a look at me, and he starts staring at me in my eyes, like glowing red eyes, and he says, "Hey, remember me? Hey, you remember me? I was this big." He motions with his hand about 3 feet above the ground, which implies I knew him when he was 3 feet tall. Or maybe I was 3 feet tall. Maybe I knew him in another time, millions of years ago, when the hobbit folk ruled Polynesia. The hobbit folk ruled Polynesia. They ruled what was Australia. They ruled the world. Little people. Tiny people. That's where this guy knew me from. It's just weird. I mean, it was weird running into this dude. It's like, don't you remember me? And I was like, I've only lived in Roosevelt for a year. I've lived in Utah for a year. I drove through here a couple times and didn't stop, pretty much, other than for like gasoline and a Coca-Cola. But I've lived here for a year, and this guy, he was probably about 30 years old. He could have been my long-lost son, but that would have been a real drunken weekend, I forgot. I mean, sometime in the 90s, I accidentally had sex with a woman. Don't remember it. I mean, that's pretty sad, because I hope I would have enjoyed it. And then this guy, but you knew me when I was this tall, 3 feet tall. So it wasn't that. I don't know. A lot of people look like a lot of people. There are a lot of ginger freaks in Utah, so I fit in here for that reason, too. A lot of redheads, a lot of ginger, a lot of those redheaded opies out there running around. Do you remember me? And I think this is going to be the last topic. So... You know, if you're a Christian out there, you struggle. And, you know, if you're a human being, you simply sin. And so as being human and Christian, we struggle with our sins. We make mistakes. And I think some of these are just mistakes in that ecclesiastical sense. Like, they're just, here's your life. It's yours. You know, obey the Lord. But the rest of it is kind of just, you know, make your own decision about whether or not you want to color inside the lines. I mean, there's a lot of this life that is about right and wrong, and a lot of it's just aesthetics, really. And it's preference and what you prefer. Like, some people like to spend their days jogging hardcore, and some people probably like to spend their evenings drinking beer, and some people do both, and that's fine. And I'm not saying one is better than the other. Some people like to smoke cigarettes. I used to smoke cigarettes. Some people like to smoke cigarettes. Do I believe that smoking a cigarette is a sin? No. Okay, no more than eating a donut or driving your car too fast. I mean, I think if you harm somebody, knowingly harm someone by driving your car too fast, that's a problem. And I also think that as a result of being reckless, if somebody's harmed, then it definitely has some kind of definite consequences you need to meditate on. But when it comes to ordinary stuff that doesn't harm anybody but yourself, this is your life. Okay, all the years of it, whether the years are short or long, this is your life. You can have it, you can take it, but obey the Lord and be a good Christian as much as possible. That is it. That's the only ask in the entire thing is obey the Lord. But the rest of it, there isn't one answer. There isn't one path necessarily. The Lord in heaven is a great planner. And his plan is very complex compared to human life. So you make a choice here and make a choice there. It turns out a lot of these paths will end up at the same point at the right time. So don't worry about that. just obey the Lord. But when it comes to the devil, as Christians, it's hard to say we ever kick the devil out. You know, the devil's funny. In terms of the life of most Christians, the devil's like some dude. It's like, hey man, you know, it's Satan. Hey dude, I got kicked out of my place, you know, Shiva and I are on the outs, fuck. And, you know, all the other, you know, dungeon mistresses, they're busy this weekend. And my new girlfriend, you know, she's a complete jerk. Can I sleep on your couch for a few days? That is the way sin gets in, you know, with the devil. And I'm not saying couch surfers are evil. That's not my point. My point is, some of them are probably evil. And the devil kind of just comes by and just wants to stay on your couch. You know, you can just, you know, drink that beer or hang out with those weird people. It won't get bad. You can just, you know, say those things. It won't turn out bad. Pick up that knife and stab that guy. You know, it does jump pretty quickly if you let the devil in. It starts out as just being okay to abuse your own body. And then it moves from abuse your own body to abuse others. And then it does just jump all the way to murder. And that's the devil. And it's hard to kick him out, but we do have to kick him out permanently. It's hard. He's always knocking on your door, always complaining about his new girlfriend, and always wanting to just spend a couple days. Just a couple days, Dan. Only until I can get my new apartment. And I'm not sure I explained it well, but maybe I just need to describe it this way. I don't know. Here's what I know. I'll start by what I don't know. I don't know if it's that easy to keep the devil out all the time. I mean, I don't know. I don't know. I know that if you try to be a good Christian, if you pray, if you read your Bible, and you try to treat your brothers and sisters in Christ, and also just your neighbors, the strangers, the orphans, you know, the widows, so to speak, if you're willing just to be a good Samaritan and decent person, the devil doesn't really have much of a shot with you, so the devil's probably not going to want to hang out with you. But it's at our darkest moments, and I've been there, and you've been there too, brothers and sisters, and if you suffer from depression, man, you can understand this. In our darkest moments, the devil will knock on your door and say, listen, buddy, you know, you're depressed and you're sad, and I have the instant solution, but can I sleep on your couch for 3 days? So on this Friday, July the 8th, 2022, Bo Blimp Doc, when all the Higgis freaks are now wandering the wilderness looking for their own sector wine, when all the glimbic folk are now imbusilated, touching their bronic points, massaging their crocus as the juices flow. They touch their binctus. They push the butt bloob. They form the butt tube. And now you're in love. So all you freaks out there on July the 8th, 2022, Bo Blimp Doc, have a happy Friday. You know, be kind, be good. And remember, if you're looking for a priest, a minister, or a guru, you've always only had one, and his name is Jesus Christ.